Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. By now, you've heard new details about the reasons that Minnesota Public Radio severed its long-term relationship with Garrison Keillor. You can find the open letter to listeners and NPR members that CEO John McTaggart released on Tuesday afternoon, and you can hear an NPR News investigative story about the workplace atmosphere at a Prairie Home Companion and Writer's Almanac at 11. That story's also available right now on the NPR News website. When John McTaggart spoke to NPR News yesterday about the decision to end the contract with Garrison Keillor, he said something important about workplaces, power, and consent that we want to talk about today. Here's John McTaggart.
We hold our leaders and people in power to a really high standard. Leaders and people in power determine livelihood. We determine career, whether you have a job or don't have a job, what your compensation is going to be. And there's a pretty clear set of policies that have guided our decision-making about what's appropriate.
And that's where we're going to begin. How do we manage the reality of personal relationships and what is often an uneven power dynamic in the workplace? I mean, there are bosses and subordinates. How do we manage the exchanges between them? Are all workplace relationships now simply out of bounds? How do you know when something spills over into harassment when it seems rather innocuous at first? So you can see this is complicated. As our guests join us, I want to hear from you. Have you struggled with this? Where the professional ends and the personal begins in the workplace? Have you had to handle dating requests from bosses? Are you confused about what's appropriate when it comes to a personal relationship in the workplace? Does it feel different today? So a number of things to consider there. I guess what I'm really asking is for your own personal experience with this in the workplace, among perhaps your circle of friends or within your family or your own. Have you struggled with this idea of maybe something that starts out innocuous, gets more serious, where the professional is, where the personal is in the workplace? I'd like to hear about that today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Our guest today, Carla Altmaier, is a lawyer and co-founder of Healing to Action. It's a Chicago-based organization committed to ending gender violence, and she's with us today from Chicago. And Carla, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me again, Carrie.
Hi Feldblum is with us. She's commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the EEOC put out a comprehensive report on workplace harassment in the summer of 2016. We've actually talked about that in a number of conversations this past year. She joins us from Florida. And hi, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I want to talk about the nuance of the power dynamics in a workplace, because as I've indicated, I think it's much more complicated than boss and employees, there shall be no personal relationships. Do you have a sense of that from having compiled the report and then what you've been seeing over the last few months?
Sure. There's no doubt that the workplace is different than outside the workplace, right? Because you don't get a choice not to come in the next day and work if you need your money. So obviously there's a problem in terms of a boss that is coming on to you in a way that does not feel comfortable, and you just feel, you know, you can't really push back. But as we talk about this, let's also note that it can be uncomfortable if you have a coworker who is continually saying things about you, sexually suggestive comments, asking you out for the date for the fifth time. That can also make you feel uncomfortable and make it difficult for you to come to work. Now, again, some of this stuff may not be illegal harassment, and we can talk about that.
We will.
But it's still actions that you shouldn't have to experience if you are getting up, going to work to make a living.
Carla, Hi hit on something here that I also want to delve into, and that is it doesn't have to be a straight line between they're my boss, I'm their subordinate. This can get complicated with maybe someone who manages other people and is your colleague and your coworker. And as she used the example, has asked you out five or six times. I mean, how do we figure out these different levels of power and then what's appropriate with that?
I think Hai hit on something really important in describing the power dynamics in the workplace, which is essentially a person is going there to work, to earn, to support, to support their families. And if something happens that jeopardizes the possibility of that opportunity, that job opportunity no longer being there, that's where we can really think about those power dynamics at play. I mean, I think we also have to think about industries where there are customers, customers who are tipping, and they hold the power there to ensure that workers can get paid, right, and have a living wage. And if a customer is not satisfied, they can then go to the manager. So those power dynamics are really all over the workplace, no matter which way you cut it.
You know, Hai, I was thinking about, given what Carla just said, about the stories that the New York Times have written about the Ford plants in Chicago. And, those weren't direct line supervisors. But what was happening is the supervisor was refusing, in many cases, to intervene with groups of men on the assembly line or in the workplace. I mean, again, this is... I might work right next to you, but there's still a power dynamic that might prevent me from reporting the harassment or even recognizing it as illegal harassment. What do we do about that?
We need to change culture. I mean, it's really as simple and as hard as that. You want to be able to come to work and feel okay. And if you're going to work on a line and there is uncomfortable stuff happening in terms of sexist comments that are not sexual but just sexist or sexualized comments, and your boss is doing nothing about that, that's a problem. So what do we do about it? We have to change the incentives for that supervisor. I mean, let's be real, that supervisor is often of the same culture as the other people who are making these comments.
Right.
Right? So you have to change the incentive for that supervisor. It has to come down from the top that if someone complains to you about unwelcome conduct happening in the workplace, or you observe it, and you then don't do something about it, you, the supervisor, will be held accountable.
I mean, now we're talking, Carla, and I wanted to get into this about witnesses and bystanders and the roles that they play in, maybe when the person who is being given this attention doesn't want it but doesn't feel like they can talk about it, what are we laying new obligation and responsibility where maybe it always should have been, but new in the Me Too movement at the feet of people who are witnessing it, people who have seen it, know that it's going on?
Well, I'm not sure if we're putting obligation necessarily on the people who are seeing it. I think what the Me Too movement really is about is holding those accountable who are doing it. I do think, though, that witnesses and bystanders are in a difficult position when they're witnessing the violence happening, because at the end of the day, and I think, you mentioned this, Carrie, the Ford plant, there was this culture also of preventing a snitch culture, right?
That's right.
People were really afraid of explaining what was happening. And also, I think, for a person to disclose violence, they recognize what the ramifications are. You know, again, we're talking about people's livelihoods. And that is definitely something, a thought that's going through a survivor's mind is how is my disclosure going to impact not just me, but the person who is involved? Is that person going to retaliate against me either in the workplace or personally? There's just a lot of factors that the person is, both witnesses, bystanders, and the survivor are weighing.
Mark says on Twitter, in my late 20s, I learned that the workplace was where women got about 80% of their dates. For men, much less so. I wonder. He says, still true. Question mark. Is seeing the workplace as a dating pool a huge part of the problem? And then Mallory says, my partner and I met at work. We've been together for over 6 years, but he was never my superior. I think it gets a lot trickier when it's between a superior and their subordinate. Hi, what would you say about that? Is that where it's only tricky, or is it just tricky in the workplace overall?
Oh, I think it's tricky in the workplace overall. There are different types of dynamics, again, to be more careful in terms of supervisors. But look, I met my partner at work 20 years ago.
Okay? Did you really? Okay.
Yeah, and she and I are married now. And, you know, I mean, it's not that you can't meet people at work that you might then date. Okay? Let me tell you, women know when they want to go out on a date with someone that they've met at work, and they know when they don't. This is actually not a hard thing for women to know, and hopefully it's not a hard thing for men to know. EOC has dealt with cases where men have been propositioned by women for dates over and over again. If you believe as a man that a good dating strategy is to ask someone for a date 5 times because, who knows, she may be playing hard to get, fine. You can continue to have that dating strategy outside of work. But inside work, where that woman has to come back every day and hear you ask her out for a date for the 6th time, no, that's not okay. And that's that. We are not talking about not having people meet their partners at work. We're talking about making it feel okay for women and men to come to work, and certainly not to have to experience some of the blatant, horrible stuff that happened, like at the Ford factory, as described, or even the just constant asking out for a date. There's a continuum of behavior here. But if you focus on respect in the workplace, just focus on that, that will cover the continuum. And Carrie, on what you said in terms of new obligation or responsibility, there's an obligation on supervisors to take action if they see or hear of unwelcome conduct. That's an obligation. Witnesses, bystanders, there is no legal obligation. There should be, I hope, ultimately an internal motivation to want to do something, but that will happen only if they are supported by the leadership. Leadership says, we want you to come tell us.
Let's take some calls on that to Stephanie in Minneapolis. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks so much for waiting. And tell me how this is working in your work life, what you're thinking about.
Sure. So I had just called in because I think one of the things missing from this conversation is the role of consultants and consulting relationships in those power dynamics. Mm-hmm. I think we're selling ourselves short if we make this just about sex. The truth is, we need to be thinking about, if we're really moving towards a contract-based economy, how do we teach women to negotiate for themselves, and how do we flatten out some of those power dynamics so that those who are working on contracts can grow their career and not have that contracting relationship held over their heads in ineffective ways, whether that's taking your work or just creating a difficult environment.
This is such a great point. I was just hearing a story the other day about how many people are doing this kind of contract work. Carla, especially, I think as Stephanie's pointing out, especially precarious. You're not a full-time employee. You're coming in on a short-term basis, potentially. You want that contract, but you're walking into an environment that could be very complicated when it comes to power. What would you say to that?
You know, I think that is an important conversation to be having, especially right now with the gig economy, where you're having those contracts both in, you know, office spaces, but also in, you know, when you're talking about Uber or Lyft drivers and share riding. And I think one of the issues there, right, is that contract is held over an individual. But the power dynamic there, though, is a very similar one to anyone in an employment situation, because ultimately there's no guarantee that you'll be able to stay in that employment, right? A lot of these employment situations are at will, meaning that either you can leave or the employer can dismiss you for whatever reason.
Right.
So everyone is kind of balancing this act.
Carla Altmaier is one of our guests this morning, and Hi Feldblum with us today from the EEOC. Carla Altmaier with us from Healing to Action. as we are, of course, taking note on the big news of the day, you probably saw it in the headlines in the Star Tribune, and you've heard it here on NPR News, new details about the reasons that Minnesota Public Radio severed its long-term relationship with Garrison Keillor, and then an open letter from NPR CEO John McTaggart talking about some of the questions and the decisions that were made as they prepared to sever this relationship. All of this is online. You can go to nprnews.org, read the letter for yourself from John McTaggart, listen to the story or read through the story at nprnews.org. We're asking, though, about some of these questions that came up as NPR and many other organizations have grappled with this. Where the professional begins and ends, where the personal begins and ends in the workplace. Are you concerned about what's appropriate when it comes to a personal relationship in the workplace? And I want to talk about this line between illegal and unethical, where the power dynamic fits in with that. I think Hai can help us with that as well, about this doesn't feel right. Does it rise to the level of being illegal? Have you had to ask yourself that? Have you been in a situation where that's been something you've struggled with in the workplace? What are some of the questions that come up for you about this? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. As I was thinking about this show today, Carla and Hai, I heard a story this morning on NPR News about Pennsylvania Congressman Pat Meehan, who told one of the aides in his office that he deeply admired her and that she was his soulmate. Now, he says this wasn't harassment. She, the person whose these attentions were given to, says it was, and she filed a complaint. Here's what the congressman said about it to WHYY.
It related to the kind of kindred spirit that was going through the experiences that we shared together. And in my job, as with all colleagues like this, you know, there are highs, there are lows, there's excitement, there's all kinds of things that you deal with.
So, Hai, what do you hear in that?
Well, obviously, I can't comment on any particular situation.
Just in his explanation.
Right. I mean, we have to take into account human nature and realities of a workplace as we're figuring out what is unwelcome, inappropriate conduct. That's what investigations are designed for, right? Someone might say something that really is intended and not in any unwelcome way. And under the law, by the way, something has to be both actually unwelcome to the person, to be illegal, which is different from what I think we need to sometimes stop. But to be illegal, it has to be experienced as unwelcome by the person. And a reasonable person should also see that as something that would be unwelcome.
Okay.
You have those two. So that's what would happen in terms of a legal analysis. And, you know, in terms of just what you want, I mean, again, I personally would not, you know, probably bother me if someone said you're my soulmate, right? But I think it is about, as I said, sort of general respect in the workplace. But understanding these are human nature interactions.
So just to be clear here, for the behavior to rise to the level of being illegal, you have to have a reasonable perception of it being unwelcome and a perception of what that why that behavior should be unwelcome.
No.
Okay,
no.
I want to understand
that's
this.
That's right. So for the person has to actually feel like it's unwelcome. Now, usually if the person has complained, they feel like it's unwelcome. So that's sort of, the person has to feel that it is unwelcome. In addition, if you're actually in a court of law, right, you have to, number one, show that it's persistent. I mean, if it's not severe, like if it's sexually assaulted or a bad epithet
right,
or whatever.
Right.
But it has to be sort of consistent enough to create a hostile work environment. And then someone looking at it from the outside would have to say a reasonable woman would have also considered this unwelcome.
Okay.
See, that's why the law, I don't know that the law often helps people as much as it should, because it's a high standard. So what we're trying to do at the EEOC, what our report said, was don't focus on trying to tell people what the law is. Just focus on saying what is not accepted in terms of unwelcome conduct.
Okay.
And again, remember, what someone else says they said is not necessarily what actually happened from either side. The person bringing the allegation or not, that's what an investigation is for.
I mean, Carla, that's why I pulled this example of this congressman. I mean, he doesn't, you can hear him explain, he does not think that this was out of bounds. She thought it was unwelcome and complained. I mean, where, in your view, how do you navigate something like that? I think a lot of the men who women would say are giving them unwelcome attention, men would say, so what? I asked her out three times, or I told her how much I admired her. What's wrong with that? How do we understand that?
I think this is a similar conversation that's happening with the accusations against Aziz Ansari, where we're trying to figure out what is, we're trying to draw a line. But here's what I think. I think we should not be trying to draw a line. The reality is that there is an assumption that women are available for sex. And, you know, even this is even reflected in the law when you see that you have to prove that this was unwanted. So part of it, you know, and that really puts the onus on a woman to be able to, or a person experiencing the harassment, to show that this was unwanted. I think, you know, in when we're thinking about how to think about, you know, how to address this complicated situation, we need to really take a step back and reflect, why is it the case that someone has to prove it was unwanted? Why is it the case that someone has to show they didn't want to have sex in the first place? Why can't it be we do not engage in that when we are told not to, or yes means yes?
A call here from Laura in St. Paul. Hi, Laura. How are you hearing this?
Hi, I'm calling. I have a slightly different take on this, and it's something that we don't talk about as much. And that's not sexual harassment, but it's bullying and intimidation, where a male boss is humiliating and intimidating a female subordinate in public and in meetings. It's not actionable, but it creates a hostile work environment. I'd love to hear what your speakers have to say about that.
Carla, what would you say?
I would say that that's sex discrimination. That's treating someone differently because of their sex, right? And making it really clear that that person is less than others because of their gender.
How about you, Hi?
Absolutely. I mean, that is actionable. People seem to think that sexual harassment means it has to be sexual. It doesn't under the law. If you are making degrading, humiliating comments to women because they're women, and creating a hostile work environment, that's sex-based harassment. And if it rises to a certain level, it is actionable and illegal. And even if it doesn't rise to that level, an employer should not want it in his or her workplace.
Jessica says, called in to say from Minneapolis, I'm in a workplace and was approached for a date by a superior. It felt unethical, but I felt like I couldn't say no without getting my job in trouble. I just ended this relationship, but it felt like there was no good way to say no. What to do in this situation? Hi, I think that's a really good example of why this is difficult to figure out and why this seems so complicated. Is if you feel, well, she felt the attention was unwelcome. She also felt like her job may be damaged by saying no. What to do in that situation?
Well, a lot of employers have rules that a superior cannot ask someone below him or her for a date. And although that's not legally required, I actually see that as a very prudential thing to do. It's because people can feel uncomfortable. Other people might not. So, but that's a prudential thing that an employer might choose to do.
Mm-hmm. It sounded like you were going to add something.
No, I mean, you know, the reason I keep coming back to respect is that people find it hard to to complain about things. They just do. I mean, our research shows that people don't come forward. And that's bad for the employer, because that means there could be harassment going on that the employer doesn't know about.
I mean, your 2016, the EEOC 2016 report found how prevalent harassment is and how often it's unreported. That was like the big news out of the report.
And therefore, part of what trying to get employers to train their supervisors to do is to say thank you when someone comes forward with a complaint.
I see.
Thank you for coming here. Thank you for giving me the chance to look into this. That's the incentive we need to create for supervisors and other people who hear this.
Okay, a call here, I think, on your use of the word respect from Cindy in Minneapolis. Hey, Cindy, hi. Hey, Cindy, are you there? Okay, so Cindy was going to call to say, one of the guests brought up the issue of respect. That was you. Hi. If you're being respectful, you shouldn't be in trouble. The state of Minnesota passed an anti-bullying law, which handles issues of respect. Does legislation like that work? Carla, what would you say?
Part of having legislation is also ensuring that it's implemented in a meaningful way. I think, you know, in Illinois, for example, we have a lot of really great laws addressing different forms of gender-based violence, and yet that's not stopping the violence. And I think for employers, what they tend to do is they tend to look at the law and say, what's the bare minimum I need to do in order to meet the requirements of the law, without really thinking about their role, which is they're bringing in people from all walks of life to share a common space and to also depend on each other. And everyone is coming in with a different idea of what does it mean to respect somebody.
That's true.
And so part of that is really, you know, an employer should take the additional step of opening up these conversations within their workplace and shift that culture, especially when there's workplace cultures where pornography is allowed to be on display and people aren't saying anything about it, and they're just seeing that as normal as long as someone is, you know, being very polite to somebody. So there just has to be that conversation within that space.
Carla, I thought you were on one of our shows where we were talking about sexual harassment training. Maybe this came up in the EEOC report and how ineffective it is.
Yes. And again, it's mostly because employers are conducting the training as a result of trying to meet the law rather than really trying to shift the culture in the workplace. And I think for a lot of employers, they don't see themselves as that, you know, as the organization or the entity that has that responsibility to really shift the culture. But the reality is that they do. They have to, because what is reasonable is changing. What is respect is not, it's not necessarily changing, but now it's being spoken of and it's being addressed. And they need to be listening and then starting to open up those conversations beyond just what the law requires.
Hi, is that the case that many companies are doing the bare minimum and I think, as you suggested, are not welcoming reports about this, are not really modeling what a company that wants to eliminate this in the workplace could do. Is that right?
That is what we found in our research and that we described in the report. And again, not to cast aspersions on employers, but we did find that a lot of training has not been effective. Now, some people took that as a proposition that training doesn't work.
I see.
That's not right. The research also shows that workplaces that don't have explicit policies against harassment and don't have training have more harassment. But if employers are doing training just to check the box to say we did it for purposes of legal liability down the line, it will not have the impact that the employer wants. Training has to be one component of a comprehensive anti-harassment effort that includes leadership and policies and good complaint procedures and no retaliation, right? You have all of that, then you add training on top of it that explains what to do, then training can work.
By the way, you mentioned retaliation, and I know that's something else that came up in the EEOC report, yes?
Oh, lots of people, when they do finally get the courage to say something, end up getting retaliated against. I mean, almost half. So what message does that send to the next person who chooses then not to speak up? But you see, that's why we also recommend in the report not just to do the sort of more effective regular training, but what we call and what the EEOC just rolled out a few months ago, respectful workplaces training,
mm-hmm.
which is a much more skills-based training, okay? And it's not even specifically on sex, race, etc. I mean, it is on those bases overall, but it teaches people the skills for how to give feedback when they experience unwelcome conduct, and it teaches other people the skills of how to respond when they get that feedback, right? It teaches managers the skills of how to engage in that situation. Let's give skills-based training, not legal term training, and let's create a culture. And of course employers are responsible for culture. They help create the culture as leaders. Let's create a culture where people feel comfortable coming forward.
Lois says, harassment is harassment. The sexual part is add-on. If you wouldn't say do something to another person, it is out of line to a subordinate. And we're hearing from House Member Carlos Mariani here, who says, as an elected official, I know there's a power imbalance here. He's responding to this issue with Congressman Pat Meehan. He says a congressman knows that. If true, then he was wrong. Helpful discussion today, especially the distinction between seeking guidance from the law and common sense and decency. Yeah, I like that phrase here for this conversation. And Representative Mariani says, we need both. If you've just gotten in on the discussion, of course, we are taking note of the news of the day. More details coming out about Minnesota Public Radio's decision to sever its long-term relationship with Garrison Keillor. You can read an open letter from NPR CEO John McTaggart to audience members and members of Minnesota Public Radio about details. And then you can hear an NPR News investigative story about the workplace atmosphere of A Prairie Home Companion and Writer's Almanac. It's online right now. You can hear it again at 11 o'clock. We are talking about this idea of power and consent and the complexity of this and how the perceptions of that are changing in this Me Too moment. Hi Feldblum is with us. She's a commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. They put out a big report in June of 2016 that I've been drawing on for these conversations about sexual harassment. And Carla Altmaier with us. She's an attorney and she's co-founder of Healing to Action. I want to hear about your experience with this and your, you know, decision making around when to report. Was it unethical? Was it illegal? I think your experience in the workplace, perhaps among your circle of friends, maybe you've been talking about this with your friends. I'd like to hear about how that fits into what we're talking about today. 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. And to the phones to Sarah in Tracy, Minnesota. Sarah, sounds like you're kind of in the midst of a situation that fits our discussion today. What's happening?
Yes, I am. And thank you, Carrie, for letting me speak with you. We have this is a city council situation, but it affects the city of Tracy administration. And we have a council member who has harassed our administrator enough that she has quit her job. And the women that are left in the office are afraid to say anything because of this council member who has, as a matter of fact, we put together a petition to get rid of the council member, and this council member's family members and friends called the people on the petition and harassed them. So people in the town say, oh, that's just him. That's the way he is. Quit making waves. You guys are just, I can't even use the word, we've been called all kinds of names. But there are, and so your speaker said that when someone goes against a woman, mm-hmm. that can be considered sexual harassment and creating a hostile work environment. We are dealing with that in Tracy, Minnesota right now.
Well, let me ask this, Sarah, to Carla and Hi. Are there in a situation like this, High, are there methods of, you know, going up through an investigative chain here? I mean, what should happen in a political situation like this?
Well, every workplace, political or otherwise, needs to have a policy of what's not acceptable conduct and who to complain to. So presumably there is some system there should be, that as a first step people should use. Often people don't feel comfortable that things will happen, even if they complain. It sounds like complaints have happened. And that's when you go to an outside legal entity like us,
okay,
like the EEOC. And, you know, we've got an 800 number, and you can call, or you even better look on the web for the closest office. And, you know, an investigator will take that information. I wish we had more money and we could act more quickly with each of the complaints, but we do look at each of the complaints.
So, Sarah, have you utilized the EEOC yet for this?
Well, I know the administrator has gone to get some help. I don't think she went through the sexual harassment side of it. We do not have a policy in place.
Hmm.
And when we brought it up, I asked specifically, who do we talk to when there's this situation? They said the council. Well, he's on the council.
Yeah, right. It sounds to me, High, confirm this, that you are suggesting this would be at least a case worth reporting to the EEOC.
I mean, I don't know the facts, right? So I don't want to overstate, but we get a lot of questions, and then we can help guide the person as to whether there is a legal complaint here. But every workplace has to have a way of reporting that gives more than just one route to report.
Yes.
I mean, that is really essential for any sort of fair reporting system.
Carla, on Twitter here, a good question. Listener says, great conversation. Can your guests suggest where startups can find templates for forming policies that could be the foundation for a respectful workplace culture? I mean, earlier we were talking about the gig economy. I like this idea of where startups go. What would you suggest?
Yeah, actually, you know, Healing to Action started last year. And so we're in a similar position where we are also trying to make sure that we have our policies. One is to reach out to other companies similarly situated who have a similar, small employee pool.
Mm-hmm.
Another is, I think the EEOC, and correct me, High, if I'm wrong, but I think that they have guidelines as well as to what the harassment policy should include. But third, I actually think that you should talk with your employees to find out what this policy should entail.
Yeah.
In a lot of my work that I've done in talking with workers from all across all low-wage industries, one of the consistent themes that comes up is that workers want to have a continuous conversation about gender because just having one isn't enough to really address that cultural the cultural differences and perspectives
that's
people
really
are bringing
good
into the workplace.
Carla,
so
that's
some ideas.
That's really good because as in, we have a policy and that's it. Not sufficient anymore. Yes?
Yes.
Right. And you've mentioned the report a few times. And what I would also recommend, and anyone can just Google EEOC harassment report and it'll come up. You'll see we also have checklists. You know, you don't have to read the whole 60 pages, although I think they're good. But you can just go to the end and there are checklists for what you want in a good policy. There's a checklist for what you want in a good complaint and investigation system. Words are very important. Don't underestimate the power of words in a policy. But you then have to make sure that it's all being implemented, and that includes the whole continuum of, as Carla said, talking to your employees, demonstrating leadership, and we actually have a checklist for leadership. So download that one.
Excellent. Anna says on Twitter, I've been retaliated against every single time I reported sexual harassment in the workplace. I was in the service industry at the time, and in both instances, when I showed up for my next shift, I no longer had a job. Exactly what comes out, by the way, on that EEOC report on retaliation to Allison in St. Paul. Allison, you've also experienced this issue of retaliation. Is that right?
I have. And I really, it's just a comment and a thank you to both of you, Carrie. I love listening to your show, and
thank
this
you.
Has been really helpful for me. because I've experienced workplace harassment, but it was the comment you made just before the break that sexual harassment is not necessarily about sex. And I never thought of it that way. I kept my mouth shut. I didn't do anything about it. And the issue about this for me was that I was overseas and I couldn't, and he's an American boss. I couldn't just leave. I would have had to pay for myself to repatriate back to the United States. And so I'm still recovering from it. My family has gone, you know, I'm talking to everybody. I'm much better, but, I had a recent experience where I'm still retaliated against indirectly, from being a reference, or I've just learned indirectly that he's saying things about me that aren't true to colleagues that are in our industry. So,
wow.
That's I think this particular individual has issues, but still, everything that you've been saying, from not knowing what to say, not knowing how to report it, not wanting to rock the boat, being afraid of what's going to happen. Will I get fired? Will I be listened to? All of that happened to me, and I never thought of myself as someone in this position. And I know, even though it happened to me, I still never thought of it in this context. And so it's just really a thank you to both of you for really laying this conversation out the way you are, and what a company should do, and not to be afraid to complain regardless, you know.
I'm really glad you heard the show, Allison. I appreciate that. And I wanted to talk about retaliation. Hi, and Carla, what do you do if you've gone through the chain, you know, you've complained as you can and should, and yet you are showing up for the shift for a job you no longer have, the person is blackballing you from some other position. What do you do?
Well, retaliation is itself a second legal offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you that when we bring cases, we often win them on retaliation.
Really?
Because that's even, because it's easier to show.
Right.
But let's be clear, law is not the best answer here. I mean, I want a culture so that what happened to Allison doesn't have to happen to someone else, because the employer has set it up to say, I'm going to take this seriously, and I will not tolerate retaliation, okay? But until we get to that world, I think it's important for people to know that if you come to the EEOC with a complaint of harassment, and then the next week you've been retaliated against,
mm-hmm.
you come back again, because that's a second legal claim. But the other thing to note is that the way the law is set up, we as commissioners, each of the five commissioners, can bring a charge ourselves if there's evidence that something bad is going on and the people themselves don't want their names used or be involved. So I want people to know that they can come to the EEOC, give the information, and say, there's a lot of this going on. I would like to see if there's a commissioner's charge that can be brought instead of just in my name. Let's have people come in and ask for that.
Hi, how backlogged are you?
Way too backlogged.
Okay.
I mean, it'll take months sometimes. But the point is, even with the backlog, we are consistently trying to move through.
So get the process going.
Get it going, and if we can do a commissioner's charge, then that can bump it up.
Hi, I really appreciate the time this morning. Really insightful. Thank you so much for making time to be with us. Carla, retaliation. I mean, what if it is as subtle or as difficult to put your finger on as the harassment has been? And I think that happens. What's your recommendation?
The unfortunate reality is that people who do come forward risk retaliation, because even though the law provides a way to respond to it, it doesn't provide a way to prevent it. And I think in a lot of the cases I litigated, that is something people are weighing. I think one way to kind of really change this or address this is by just recognizing that this is the reality of it, but working to try to change the legislation so that there is a requirement for employers to not to protect against retaliation from happening in the first place.
Call here from Simon in Grand Rapids. Hey, Simon, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for taking my call. And I would say I really do appreciate the conversation. I think it's about time and a conversation we need to have, and I appreciate all the efforts you've put into this, Kerry.
Thanks.
And I totally want to be the first in line for supporting, you know, these some of these egregious things that have happened. I want to be totally behind that. Just calling back to the one thing that was said a while ago about what a reasonable person would consider harassment or acceptable. I really do think for me that's a pretty gray area. For example, I've worked in a number of jobs where I've been on duty around the clock, for example, emergency medical services and things like that. There's women and men mixed there. People are together a lot of time, and needless to say, people start to interact. The people become friends and start to interact like they do with their friends. You know, I don't think you can really expected in some ways to be any otherwise. For both sexes, then you hear things, you know, you hear people start to make sometimes off-color jokes. People start to tease a bit, occasional comment about, you know, what somebody might like to do, you know, and I've heard that from both men and women. I'm sure we all have many people, we've heard these from our friends. And
so,
and
Simon,
when the work environment becomes social.
If I may, Simon, we're a little short on time. May I just put that back to Carla, which is kind of these gray areas? I mean, what do you do, Carla, when the jokes are circulating or, as Simon is describing, things are getting a little too personal? Is it your, if you're in that situation, is it, you know, really your responsibility to say, I'm uncomfortable with this, to let people know, to not assume that they will know not to be talking like that and going on?
Well, I think it's the responsibility of an employer to prevent that from happening in the first place.
Really?
In the sense that they should be having trainings and conversations about consistently about what is acceptable workplace behavior. But I do think if a person is, you know, finds to be, you know, is offended by what is said, of course, I would encourage that person to raise that with management and higher ups in employment situations and ensure that talk about what they want to change. And that is then an opportunity for employers to, you know, open up a conversation. But I think, you know, this idea that employers don't really know, that is not true. And you see examples like the Ford plant where they knew what was happening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the most extreme situation, and I know it's not exceptional, but I hear Simon in things get loose and then they get a little looser. I don't know that I expect my, you know, the head of the company to tell everybody in the newsroom there will be no joking of any, you know, I assume people are people and it's going to happen. But I also feel like this is a moment when you can feel empowered to say, just don't like that. Don't feel comfortable with that. And I think I hear you saying maybe that's too much to expect from individuals.
I think that it's challenging still for individuals because, again, they're figuring out, they're weighing the cost, you know, they're doing a cost-benefit analysis.
For sure.
So, you know, I do think that people should feel empowered to go forward and talk about this. But I also think employers need to be recognized that they also have a role to play. And what we've seen in the past, right, is employers say, oh, well, that was just a joke, or that's just how so-and-so is. When they need to really think about, well, this is actually a reflection of a conversation that needs to be had and maybe some training and information for everybody to get on the same page.
Carla, I'm really grateful that you make time for us. You bring a lot of wisdom and insight to the discussion. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Carrie. Great to be on your show.
And you. Andrew is asking if I'm going to tweet out a link to the discussion. I am. He says I got caught in the caught it about the middle and would like to share it with my wife and her colleagues. Yes, I'll tweet out a link to this. You can find all of the conversations we've been having about sexual harassment and the Me Too moment on the podcast, but you can also go back and look in on the archives online. And yep, I will tweet a link to that.